Good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia, and welcome to the month of November. You will note on the periodical, on our little schedule, that the month of November is dedicated to the idea of basic theosophical principles, and that's where we're going in terms of Sunday presentations and certainly on our Wednesday night activities. In order to put the schedule of activities into the proper focus, we'll start this morning's session with a reading of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. That brief statement could be studied for this life and lifetimes to come in terms of finding a way to study a philosophy, and then to make every endeavor to actually live it. Here in Philadelphia, the volunteers who are associated with the cause plan all activities around this declaration. On Wednesdays, the building opens promptly at 5:15. There are always students or associates available in the library at the front of the building to assist you with reference work of any kind. If you would like to study ahead for a particular class, if you would like to research an idea that you heard in this room and you want to know more about, if there's a life problem that you're looking for information with that struggle, whatever it is, the student can help you on in a reference library that's straight-line theosophical literature. That library remains open until 7:15, and on Wednesday night, promptly at 7:30, a study class is held in this particular room. During this current season, we're using the Key to Theosophy as a common study text, and you can pick up a schedule near the usher's table to show you what pages we're on for a particular week. If you're working from home, you certainly can avail yourself at an at-cost purchase from the book table to have the actual book in your hands at home, or you could go to our website or that one in Phoenix, Arizona, New York, LA, wherever, and you can come up with the Key to Theosophy by H.P. Blavatsky, and you can get the articles that way online. Before and after library and Wednesday night classes, the book table is open, just as it is on Sunday mornings. And the volunteer seated there can help you make purchases, can help clarify the schedule. Or if you feel in your heart of hearts that this is a movement that has ethical meaning and value to humankind, then you could talk to that person as well about volunteering in some way. You'll note from the declaration that there's absolutely no official kind of organization involved, and there's therefore no tithing, there's no collection of dues, et cetera, et cetera. Attendance is free, and this entire effort, experimental or otherwise, practical to be sure, is based on voluntary contribution of time, service, money, all sorts of effort. During the month of November, as I said just slightly earlier, the theme is basic theosophical principles. Next Sunday morning is November 13th, and the title that particular day for a panel will be Law, Chance, or Miracle. A really good statement of theosophical principles with plenty of time thereafter to explore the applications and to bring our critical mind to looking into the subject matter and pulling it apart a bit together. This morning, November 6th, our topic is a forum presentation entitled The Unity of Life. And again, there will be a formal presentation of the subject matter in the light of theosophy with ample time thereafter for Q&A. And here comes a volunteer now.
We so often identify ourselves as Christians, Jews, Hindus, Americans, Russians, atheists, and even theosophists. Yet none of those labels describes who we really are. In fact, there are only human beings. All the labels do no more than describe what we believe, how we have been conditioned, our place of birth, our preference for one religion or another, or no religion at all. Many may recognize the truth of that, and few feel with every fiber of their being that they are at the root level, one with all of humanity as a whole. Even those among us who say that they have respect for all cultures may not sense the divine spark of life in every person we meet. We are much more likely to judge others by appearances. We see only a Polaroid snapshot of those we meet, and we tend to judge that person on the very tiny bit of information the photo provides to us. We human beings are extraordinarily complex. One moment we may appear to be wearing a halo like some saint, and in the next to be a devil, complete with horns and trident. It is easy to feel unity with someone who is displaying their saintly side, but not so easy to feel that unity when someone shows their diabolical side. The United Lodge of Theosophists is open to all who are in sympathy with its objectives. We are meant to see beyond the appearances of not only race, creed, and sex, but to see beyond the irritating faults of the people we meet. Universal brotherhood has no meaning at all if we only feel brotherly love towards those whom we like. This is not to say that we should be sentimental and pretend that everyone is a nice person. Some people are just not nice. Yet behind the surface irritants and faults lies their divine spark of deity with which all of us are united. This is not to say that we should be blind to the faults of others. That would be reading something into brotherhood that is not there. Brotherhood is not even a personal affection for someone. That is impossible for some, if not all, even for those that are on the path towards their higher self. Yet in spite of the faults we see in others, and in spite of the fact that some people try our patience to the very last nerve, we can still see the divine life within them, and we can still work with them for the greater good. From an awareness of underlying unity comes an altruistic way of life that is compassionate, wise, and practical. A mission of theosophy is not so much to gratify individual aspirations as it is to serve our fellow man. And by that, we mean all our fellow men. If we aspire to such a realization of the One, then we can change ourselves in such a way that we can get insight. We can lay aside our own preconceived ideas about people who see beyond the appearances to the divine life that is deep within them as it is deep within us. Simply belonging to a theosophical lodge will not bring this about. We must have an iron, a concrete, never-failing determination to bring it about in ourselves. There are thousands across the world that attend a theosophical lodge in one part of the world or another. But I wonder how many of these are true theosophists. It is very easy to put your pen to a piece of paper and say you want to belong to the United Lodge of Theosophy and that you believe in brotherhood. But brotherhood is something we should live instead of just talking about it. Theosophy is the testing ground for brotherhood. It is the place to let ourselves grow, to let ourselves understand that we are not to be dogmatic, to let ourselves learn to get along with one another, whether we like one another or not. We must be willing to have differences of opinion. It is you who are being tested. If you could think of the personalities that you meet as the acid test of your own character, of your own theosophy, you would get a different point of view. When something comes up, ask yourself how you will take it, and ask yourself what it is about you that needs to be changed. The tests are not easy. They require us to stand firm on the principle of universal brotherhood. Personal injustice is never easy to bear, but nothing truly worthwhile is ever easy. Madame Blavatsky tells us, there is a road, steep and thorny, beset with perils of every kind, yet still a road, and it leads to the very heart of the universe. The thorns and perils come as personal injustice and the arduous tasks required in the self-transformation process. There at the heart of the universe is the ultimate unity of all. Those believers in the philosophy of theosophy who even dimly sense that unity is forming a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity, those who sense it work passionately to help their neighbors to sense it. Although often veiled, the idea of universal brotherhood, of humanity, appears in the world's great religious traditions. Perhaps ultimate unity is emphasized more in Eastern religions, but it is not absent from Western religions. Now let me close by quoting the text of a beautiful Christian hymn written by an English composer named Gustav Holst 100 years ago in 1916, entitled Turn Back, O Man. This poetically expresses the longing of humanity for the ultimate unity. It begins by speaking of our destructive behavior, called in the hymn, our foolish ways. It goes on to say what might be if we awake out of our ignorance, called our haunted sleep. Finally, it predicts the time when all will realize unity. Turn back, O man, forswear thy foolish ways. Old now is earth, and none may count her days. Yet thou, her child, whose head is crowned with flame, still wilt not hear thine inner God proclaim. Turn back, O man, forswear thy foolish ways. Earth might be fair, and all men glad and wise. Age after age, their tragic empires rise, built while they dream, and in that dreaming weep. Would man but wake from out his haunted sleep, earth might be fair, and all men glad and wise. Earth shall be fair, and all her people one, nor till that hour shall God's whole will be done. Now, even now, once more from earth to sky, peals forth in joy men's old undaunted cry. Earth shall be fair, and all her folk be one. Topic for today, the unity of life.
It is in that final rendering of that song that we find a glimmer of what it is to study theosophically, to not just read words and take them at face value or memorize dogma or doctrine, etc., but rather to read critically with an open mind and look into the symbolism being used so that we can get to the ancient truths that lie veiled there. And so when we read, not shall that hour shall God's whole will be done, the whole notion of what is unity, what is God, what is divine, and what is the will is kind of veiled. But the statement that this is an old undaunted cry. This is an old intuitive, earth shall be fair. There will be eternal absolute justice, and all the folk of the earth be one. And there we've got a great deal of interpretation. So the talk was very timely, but there are many ways to consider the topic of the unity of life in addition to what was presented this morning. So what kinds of ideas did you come with this morning? Yeah.
What we have an issue with is, I mean, karmically, we understand we're born in a certain age, the experiences we have are karmic, and the experiences that other people have, you know, we're interblended with these people, but we hear, you know, things that are going on all around the world, and we know karmically those people are doing what karmically they're supposed to be doing. And but how do we look at these people that are committing heinous acts and look at them theosophically? And when we're looking at this whole idea of unity today, what do we think of them? How should we think of them?
One of the key points to the philosophy is that it is not the external world that is reality and perception. One of the key points to the philosophy is that as radiance of the whole, as each one individual thinker is an expression or an experience of the entire deific essence, we gradually learn as we study the philosophy to begin within, that the perception of what it is to be spiritual, the perception of what it is to be compassionate and altruistic and ethical, when to tolerate and when to assert, wait a second, there's a different ethical standard. All of those major questions of what it is to be a human can be answered from within first. So it's true. On a beautiful morning like today, when we've all agreed to create an illusion and set the clocks back, and we've jarred every cell of our physical bodies, we know that all of the expressions of the exterior world are illusions. They're all engagements in which people have self-identified with something and then worked to bring that through based on passion or cold logic or based on spiritual interpretation as they so define it. As we move through life and we in the international scene, the national scene, the local scene, the scene in our own homes or extended families, no matter where we find ourselves, we remain eternally a spiritual perceiver, each one of us. And this beautiful array this morning of individuals from all different walks of life and appearing, as our declaration says, you know, to look so very different, 4% of us physically different from any one of us, that's at the lowest level of the physicality. Eternally, in reality, we are all one. And if we can look in the mirror and say, as a perceiver, I remember youthful follies. I remember youthful indiscretions. I know that as I look in the mirror this morning, I have grown as a perceiver and grown in awareness of what it is to lead an ethical, selfless, or less selfish life. Then if we are all radiance of the one divine essence, every single other spark of divinity encased, involved in, expressing the human state, everyone is in that same path of spiritual growth. And as the Indians say with the namaste, where we are one in spirit, I honor you, you honor me, we are one. And by keeping that in our minds, we can steer away from getting caught up in this amazing backlog right now of competition and conspiracy and war, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all side issues that have no place in a spiritual realm of living according to the compassionate dictates of heart and mind. Your hands up. If we're working on the proposition that as observers, as was just said, we're looking around the world, we see in our home or down the street or in our workplace, wherever it is, we see someone who is exhibiting behavior or habits that are really off-putting, to say the least. If we can remain centered and feel in our heart of hearts, wow, you know, if I can recognize this, it's possible that I've either thought that way or done that thing, or if I think I can intuitively recognize the motive or the skewed logic in this particular activity, then I must have been there also, because how else would I recognize it? And in that break, I am not this personality, I am not the reactor, I'm not the physical reaction to what I'm seeing, but rather I can step back, observe it, and say, whoa, habits are tough to break. And if I'm watching this, that poor soul is establishing a karma that's going to be a humdinger to undo in the future. Then the thought might occur, if we're at one, and truly there's a universal brotherhood, and we are to create the nucleus of universal brotherhood, then how might I help the other to help himself or herself? So the recognition's there. Sure, we've got visceral, physical reactions to things, or else we wouldn't be in the human state. But by noting it, stepping away from it, and then taking it to a different level, how might I help the other help himself or herself? Yes?
Does the idea of universal brotherhood also include the lower kingdoms?
Does the universal brotherhood also include the lower kingdoms? The talk for this morning on the unity of life focused on a very much needed consideration of where humans are today. The philosophy encompasses and supports this talk that we heard this morning and far more. If you're new to the study of the philosophy, there's a first proposition, often called the first fundamental, and that notion is that there is a oneness from which all in manifestation proceeds, or in which all of manifestation proceeds. So whereas the Reverend's hymn for this morning that was read, the poetry that was read, talks about God, the student of the philosophy would look at the first fundamental and appreciate the fact that far beyond what Joseph Campbell called the masks of God or the masks of divinity, above, beyond, is an essence, is an energizing principle, is an abstract, all-encompassing, deific essence that by our finite world, in our manifested world, we really can't find many attributes for. In considering it, some folks use space as an analogy or correspondence to think about what might the deific essence be like. How could it be all-encompassing and all-inclusive but have no attributes of its own? Other folks come to the study by thinking of abstract universal motion and what that's like and how that might pertain. But philosophically, the proposition for each of us to consider is that all of manifestation is actually spirit moving into lower and lower degrees of matter, and that this universal spirit in the East would be called Atma Buddhi, with manas or mind potential. That spirit is the unifying oneness that comes forth from the Absolute. And therefore, it is said that all entities that we can see on this plane, or on a microscopic plane, or in a telescopic plane, everything in manifestation is a representation or an instrument or a form that is an expression through which mind, spirit is moving and experiencing. And that's quite a different teaching from most of the others. So we configure a unity of life among all kingdoms of nature, moving from the most ethereal, most microscopic, and gradually across incarnations and across millions and zillions of years, if you will, the expression of mind becomes more and more and more open, more and more powerful, until finally the human stage where mind, soul, that nuclear of universal brotherhood is expressing through what we know as the human state. But the talk this morning, we could undo this whole thing if we want it and say, okay, are we to feel brotherly toward microscopic life, vegetable life, animal life, mineral life? And the answer would be, if there is unity, if we indeed spring from, emanate from, radiate from one deific source, then all is sacred. All spirit behind any form of matter is one, and therefore everything in our purview becomes a sacred moment or experience. I'm talking too much. Yes.
Well, one thing we need to be aware of too is that these forms that this spiritual trinity is working through is made up of all those lower kingdoms. Mm-hmm. So in a way, you know, when we're talking about unity and we look at the physical form, an animal physical form, a plant physical form, it's like they're all made up of all these lives, all functioning together, and it's like the ultimate unity.
In the late 19th century, when this philosophy was brought over to the West and presented in printed form for the first time, the science was very different. None of the instrumentation that we've got available to us today was available then. The theory then was a very mechanical sense, scientifically, of physics, that somehow the universe worked as a giant clock, and there was a clock worker that wound everything up, set it in motion, and backed up. That everything was very concrete and for sure. And as the centuries have passed, more and more the science has caught up with these philosophical statements. And frequently in this room, you know, someone will say, here's my hand, here's the table. When I put my hand on the table and all those molecules are there together, where's the delineation at the molecular level? So if we think of our physical bodies, we can come at this, if this is indeed true, we can take the statement that we're hearing and come at it from any aspect of life. Is our physical body actually a conglomeration of the lower essences? Is the mineral kingdom existent in our body? We can think about the skeleton. We can think about the iron that's coursing through our blood. We have blood work now to test out all the various minerals that need to exist in our bloodstream, our lymph system. So we see the mineral kingdom very well active. Are we, in essence, is there some aspect of us that's like a plant? Do we not respond to sunshine in the same way that a plant does? Is there not an essence in some way, shape, or form that we need to have water? We need to take in minerals, et cetera, et cetera. So plants may not be able to move. They may not be able to speak, but there's a degree of perception there. They turn toward the sun. They find areas in which to root and grow. And who can doubt the natural ability to seek the ability to root? throw a bunch of acorns out a car window, and they will all try to come to fruition in their own ways, to reproduce and grow. But they need certain things to be able to go. There's a tree right now on the top of the roof of this building growing in a gutter. And I've been told that you could see it if you stand in the park and look back at the building. So there's a degree of nature and wisdom and innateness blooming in the vegetable kingdom. Can you think of another way that the vegetable kingdom may be resident within the human body? Yes?
Maybe the nervous system.
In the what?
Nervous system.
In the nervous system. Very, very, very much so, yeah. So that when you look at the nervous system, you can definitely see roots and the stem and the branches and the interactions of stimulation of the external to the internal. And certainly the animal kingdom, in how many ways, is reflected in the illusion of the diversity among us. That one's really easy to call. Yes?
But isn't the animal, this would be also an argument for universal brotherhood. Doesn't the animal kingdom take their cue from our thoughts and actions?
If we follow the proposition that the human stage is the human kingdom is a very high level of physicality, allowing for expression of spirit, soul, perception, creativity. If we hold with the scientific investigation of magnetics, chemical and electrical kind of components of what it is to be in a physical body, we know for sure that we generate by our use of thought. We can think of an idea and change the color of our skin. Dark folks glow, lighter folks blush red, but it's all the same process, mind over matter. And those of us that have lived with companion animals, as tiny as a gerbil, had an opportunity to experience something yesterday where a gerbil in a cage who's been living quietly under his bedding for weeks and refusing to come out, the actual owner came to visit and change the conditions in that little cage. And as soon as the owner entered the room, this little rat, cute though he might be, but just a tiny little brain of an animal, came out of his tunnel, sat up tall, almost begged to be picked up, but only for that particular human being. And how many times do you see that human beings will breed a particular animal form, train it for a particular purpose, some animal companions to become service animals, and at the opposite extreme, horrible attack animals? That's all human spirit working through this vehicle, impressing domestic animals. It stands to reason that if that happens in a domestic scene, universally or all of us collectively, imagine the impress that we give to the animals in great nature. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to relate back to also to the plants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the comment is excellent about the power of human thought volition over the lower kingdoms is now being studied scientifically. So we don't have to take the philosophy in abstraction. We can do parallel research as well. There's a Japanese study, and I can't remember the Japanese scientist's name to save my life here.
Emoto, isn't it?
I'm sorry.
Emoto
sounds about right. The water experiments that Emoto conducted, where the energy level, the rate of vibration, the nature of the water in the lab setting changed completely in correspondence and representation of what was going inside the human beings. In terms of the study with plants, there are so many studies of using sound, choosing to play a particular kind of music around the plants, choosing to speak in a particular way or emote in a particular way around plants can greatly change the scenario. So the old wives' tale of a green thumb turns out to be not too far from the truth. Way, way in the back.
We read an article where they have done molecular studies. You know, let's just use an example, a tomato plant, that when a person takes that plant and holds it and handles it, getting it ready to put in the ground, that the molecular makeup of the plant changes just enough to reflect the person mm-hmm. who was handling it.
And in the indigenous cultures in North America, South America, Middle America, the tradition of when you extract a plant from the ground, you add something of value back into that location. And that physical sacrificial action as a custom was only a symbol or a reflection of the actual heartfelt kind of contemplation or meditation or prayer, however you want to see that at the same time. But again, this is all science that can be researched that was not available when these writings came into the Western Hemisphere in the late 1800s. Way, way at the back.
My favorite story of the unity of life is about the elephants in a particular country in Africa that every year had a certain path to the water, and they would go no matter what the conditions, as a family, as a group, as a unit, through the area to the water. Well, some industrious people wanted to build a hotel there, and they decided to leave the lobby completely open, and the elephants, sure enough, the next year, traipsed through the lobby in their regular journey to the water, and it's now a very popular tourist site that people want to witness this. It's a wonderful example of man working with animal and spirit working with spirit and doing the right thing
mm-hmm.
and paying attention and so forth. So there's articles, there's YouTube pictures of this. So take a look at it if you can. It's amazing.
We're very fortunate in the time and place that we exist that the internet is so wide open right now that we can gain access to all sorts of films. You know, we may never be able to travel out of the Delaware Valley. Perhaps that's not our karma. But we can vicariously observe what folks are experiencing all over the world. And we can, in any way, shape, or form, especially if we're dealing with small children, we can look through the lens of nature around us and find examples of the unity of life and why it's so very potent and so very comforting as well. that no matter what the illusion of the moment may be, no matter what the turmoil of life's conditions may be, there's an eternal oneness, the nucleus of universal brotherhood. In the Far East, they would talk about the guru parampara chain, that from the very lowest expression of spirituality or mind, all the way up to the very highest we can imagine and beyond, there is that linkage of one helping the one lower, and so forth, all the way down the line. Yeah.
Although it's rarely mentioned in class, and there are, it's a good study, it's an interesting study, but the elemental kingdom, of which we're only told a little bit about, because we're said that if we had a lot of knowledge about it, we could really wreak havoc. But the elemental kingdom is, you know, below the other kingdoms, and it, the nerve centers for nature, and they correspond to earth, water, air, and fire, which are considered anciently the four elements. So it's just something to think about, or maybe do a private study on. But you know, it's definitely,
yeah,
it's all part of the great brotherhood, really.
Yeah, and in terms of the elementals, sprites, elves, leprechauns, you can go right around the cultures of the earth and compare legends, myths, narratives they tell to their children, folk tales, etc., and find essences in which people have experienced or have ancient comfort with spiritual points of intelligence below, far below the mineral. But again, notice that the point of the comment is that it's not often discussed here at ULT, because the invitation through the United Lodge of Theosophists is to study the philosophy, understand the ethics, and so therefore we're fitting ourselves by study of a commonality, looking at something critically, being logical about it, testing, verifying, etc. But we're fitting ourselves morally, ethically, to be mind over matter, spirit over matter, so that we do no harm. Absolutely, the highest nucleus of universal brotherhood envisioned would do no harm. There would be compassion for the other, empowerment for the other, a sense of oneness and celebration with that oneness with the other. And unless and until the dynamo that we know as the human nature, unless and until ethics are achieved and the life is led in an absolutely pure manner, don't we all come with mixed motives, tinged motives, flawed logic based on experience and perception that may be partial? And in that case, philosophically, the reality of the elementals is not dealt with, because we're advised psychism, ESP, elementals, etc. Look in the mirror. Are you a completely ethical expression of life? And if the answer is not really, then those subjects are dangerous. Yeah, way in the back.
Well, first thing I would say is, what do you mean? And the next thing that I would hear is that, well, it's a good idea to come into the library, because I remember the quote, "The Lord is my shepherd, shall not want." Well, a shepherd is somebody that leads sheep and takes care of them. And who is the Lord? But that's not enough. They don't want it. Your idea is that to stimulate our mind, we have these teachers, but they point out the way. And is there anything in the library at the book table that can help us understand what you mean?
Well, there's plenty of stuff existing in the library and in the book table. This past week, as a student, I revisited an article by Robert Crosby called "The Occult Side of Nature," and that little article is really a wonderful article because it does talk about the unity behind great nature and the aspect of spirit and deific essence that is shared or radiant throughout all. So that's a possibility to look at that particular little article, if you will. That writer reminds us that what we see of each other, what we sense of each other on this plane, is the most fractured. It's the weakest link, if you will. Whereas what is the fullness of the expression of what it is to be spirit and matter, of what it is to be a human, is actually internal, not what we perceive in the external. So that's one article that might be really good to read. And the other thing, that there's a little pamphlet that is really quite a good little companion to have with. It's called An Epitome of Theosophy. It's a set of articles that came 1886, 1888 from William Q. Judge, who was studying with Blavatsky at the time. It's a tiny little pamphlet, very lightweight, very easy to have around, and it is a wonderful synthesis of the fundamental principles and propositions of the philosophy. And so that would be another very helpful little thing to come across. For those of us that are able to get in on Wednesday night, certainly the key and the key study together is going to do a similar thing. Yes. According to the philosophy, the philosophical statement is that it is in the human kingdom where you have this incredible meshing of the great triumvirate. You've got mind, you have matter, you've got spirit coming together, so that perception in the human kingdom is finally raised to the potential for full self-actualization, Maslow's old statements in psychology. It's in the human state that soul can finally, in a self-conscious way, measure with a firm ruler and to consider cause and effect, to consider contrasts, to make a logical progression of thought from premise to conclusion, and then create a scenario. And it's in the human state that we've got physically the potential to do it. We know, you know, the chimps have a juxtaposing thumb, in terms of just the physical, there's a lot about our physical form that allows for the thought processes and the thinking. But the philosophy states that before we get all huffy and puffy, oh good, you know, we've hit the human kingdom for schnooking on the rest, the philosophy states that in potential, the same Atma Buddhi that exists in the human kingdom, in potential, the monastic or thought mind powers existent in and through the human kingdom, those exist in every point of intelligence imaginable in the universe. The potentiality is there. So the philosophy would say, we're a flash, we're a blink of the eye in this particular moment. But across eons of time, across the entire universal perspective of manifestation as we can imagine, all spirit is progressing and all spirit has potential to move through these various states or kingdoms, very, very gradually unfolding until finally each of the divine sparks would eventually rise or express itself through the human kingdom. So potential is there, but they're not all there yet. By logical extension, the invitation to us as spirit, as perceivers, as eternal thinkers, however you want to use words to express that, we have time. We have lives ahead of us. We have millions of years of expression to experience karma, to mitigate karma, to balance out karma, and to gradually hone our own use of substance, spirit over matter, mind over matter, until finally, as a ray of that unity, we are able to perceive all of the laws of great nature, all of the truth of great nature, and therefore rise to what in other time periods has been called an enlightened state. And therefore you get around the world in a variety of religions, in every location known to humankind, Mahatmas, great souls, enlightened ones, those who were far progressed spiritually and therefore could offer truth to others. Yeah, your hand's been up.
Yeah, this is just seven lines from Lao Tzu talking, addressing what we talked about this morning. The Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The nameless is the beginning of heaven and earth. The name is the mother of 10,000 things. Ever desireless, one can see the mystery. Ever desiring, one can see the manifestations. These two spring from the same source, but differ only in name.
They differ only in name. And we can find that kind of thinking from many who have been studying comparative religions, and certainly with Joseph Campbell and any number of others. We're very close to the end of our time. Again, this is a quote out of the Occult Side of Nature by Robert Crosby. Just as we have to live theosophy if we are to know the doctrine, so we have to live the life if we are to know its laws. We are never alone. Always in some of our sheaths, bodily or bodiless, we are connected with other beings, other stages, and states of substance, and other planes of consciousness. We have only to arouse ourselves, take the path, point it out, test it out for ourselves. But the power to be sought is always to become a beneficent force in nature, the nucleus of universal brotherhood. Have a great day. You too, Shri. Martin, I'm not sure I did that right. Help me, please.
We got
I hit the wrong thing.